opportunity to present this work, and thanks for coming. So I will talk today about many-body physics with atomic, molecular, and optical systems and methods. So I guess I played a little bit as a kid in Moscow, but I sort of haven't played in a while, so I'm not as comfortable with that. Maybe I will by the end. I'm not even a card-carrying quantum information theorist, so I'm even further removed. So please, interrupt me if things are confusing. So it's extremely tempting to harness the power of quantum mechanics for some cool quantum technologies. And as you very well know here, for example, by making use of quantum superposition, quantum computers are promising in certain cases to give exponential speedup over classical for certain problems. By making use of the non-cloning theorem, quantum communication is promising to be, in principle, unbreakably secure. The use of squeezed and other entangled states in precision measurements allows for increased sensitivity. But in fact, nature has already harnessed quantum mechanics for its own quantum technologies in some sense. And let me mention two examples that will come up later in the talk. Colossal magnetoresistance is a huge change in electrical resistance in certain materials under application of a magnetic field. So as a result, these materials have very good magnetic field sensors. And since computer memory is magnetic, they can in principle be used as very good hard disk read heads. Now, superconductivity, of course, is the property of certain materials to conduct electricity without resistance, and such materials could in principle be used in lossless electricity networks. However, both of these properties occur only significantly below room temperature, making their practical use difficult. In order to pursue the dream of a room temperature superconductivity, a room temperature colossal magnetoresistance, we then have to understand first, of course, how the available low temperature systems work. And then to understand and improve nature's quantum technologies, or to create our own quantum technologies, one has to understand and control large interacting quantum systems, as well as to be able to design and create new ones. And these two themes are at the heart of my research, sort of the long-term goals of my research. However, as you well know here, because of the huge size of the many-body Hilbert space, understanding and controlling large quantum systems is very hard. And given how difficult and promising it is to control such larger interacting quantum systems, this quest lies at the heart of AMO physics, that's atomic, molecular, and optical physics, and this is where I come from, quantum information science, and condensed matter physics. And so in my research, I tried to integrate tools and methods from all three of these fields to address this major challenge. So today, let me focus on the use of AMO systems to address major questions in condensed matter and general many-body physics. So the main theme here is quantum simulation, which many of you are probably familiar with. But let me review it anyway. Even if you could come up with a plausible theoretical model for a given quantum system of interest, such as, say, a high-temperature superconductor, it is often impossible to solve this model on a classical computer just because of the huge size, say, of the many-body Hilbert space. And then one of the few ways to learn something about this model is to tune another quantum system into exhibiting that model and then make measurements on that other system. So that other system would then be called a quantum simulator. So the idea would then be to use AMO systems to simulate some models that are believed to describe condensed matter phenomena. Very recently, I've been a little bit interested in using AMO systems also to simulate phenomena from high-energy physics, and I will touch on this very, very briefly at the end of the talk. However, one doesn't have to necessarily simulate phenomena that have already been observed in nature and go beyond to general exotic many-body phenomena, such as, for example, topological phases, which have no local order parameter and are instead characterized by concepts such as topological invariance or edge states, and a closely related concept of quantum spin liquids, which I will describe in some detail later. Differences between typical AMO systems and typical condensed matter systems bring with them exciting new physics. In particular, in condensed matter, it is common to study ground or near equilibrium properties of a system described by Hamiltonian. On the other hand, AMO systems are often far out of equilibrium, are evolving in time, and are subject to dissipation. So in my research, I try to develop tools and methods for describing these new types of many-body phenomena. The main theme in a quantum, in a study many-body physics with AMO systems is the use of alkali atoms in optical lattices to simulate the behavior of electrons in solids. So in this cartoon of a crystal, positively charged nuclei create a periodic potential for negatively charged electrons. Then light can actually be used to create potentials for neutral atoms. And then, in particular, standing wave light field can be used to create a periodic potential in which the atoms move. And this periodic potential is precisely called the optical lattice. And then just from the similarity between these two pictures, you can sort of imagine that atoms in these optical lattices might be very good at simulating the behavior of electrons in solids. And indeed, these systems are much easier to study because the underlying length scale here is 1,000 times larger than the underlying length scale in a crystal. Let's get a little bit more technical. If we use two internal states of a fermionic atom to encode for a spin up and spin down of an electron, and if we put such atoms in an optical lattice, we can use them to simulate the famous fermionic-Hubbard model, which is believed to play an important role in high-temperature superconductivity. So in this model, fermions can tunnel from site to site with amplitude T, and they can interact with each other when they occupy the same site with interaction energy U. In the case of cold atoms, this interaction U comes from collisions, while in the case of electrons, this interaction U would, of course, come from Coulomb interactions. Now, this model is actually notoriously difficult to solve, and it has indeed been realized in cold atoms in the groups of Tillmann-Esslinger and Emmanuel Bloch. If we use two standing waves, we can create a two-dimensional lattice potential for neutral atoms. And then this real-time movie of a thermal hopping of such neutral atoms in a two-dimensional optical lattice in the group of Marcus Greiner shows very vividly, I would say, the excitement over ultra-cold atoms. Indeed, in this case, the atoms are bosonic. But a fermionic apparatus with similar imaging capabilities is very likely going to be built very soon. And then an experiment of this kind would actually closely correspond to looking at and controlling individual electrons in solids, which, of course, would be very exciting. So while this is indeed all very exciting, I would say there are fundamental challenges associated with using alkali atoms in optical lattices for simulating various many-body phenomena. In particular, while the Hubbard model is indeed very hard to solve, and it is very important, it is somewhat difficult to get access to truly exotic physics, such as, for example, the physics of topological phases or these quantum spin liquids with alkali atom optical lattices. Furthermore, interactions between neutral atoms, such as alkali atoms, are weak, and therefore they're difficult to observe experimentally. So in the remainder of the talk, I will show that alkali and earth atoms and polar molecules provide solutions to these challenges. In particular, thanks to the unique electronic level structure of alkali and earth atoms, they actually allow one to get access to a truly exotic physics, such as the physics of quantum spin liquids or topological phases, while long-range interactions between polar molecules are much stronger than interactions between neutral atoms and also allow one to get access to exotic physics. So with this, let's start then with alkaline earth atoms. Alkaline earth atoms have two outer electrons and form the second column of the periodic table. We will be interested in alkaline earth atoms with nuclear spin, but turns out that all bosonic alkaline earth atoms have zero nuclear spin. And therefore, for the remainder of the talk, we will only discuss fermionic alkaline earth atoms. So let's review the electronic level structure of fermionic alkaline earth atoms on the example of strontium-87. And in this slide, we will actually ignore the nuclear spin. Since we have two outer electrons, they can be either in a singlet state or in a triplet state. And therefore, there will be a ladder of electron spin singlet levels and a ladder of electron spin triplet levels. The lowest two states are the singlet S0 state and a triplet P0 state. So here, the notation is that these three labels describe the spin, orbital, and total electronic angular momentum. So that's why this is a 2s plus 1 singlet, and this is 2s plus 1 triplet. turns out the transition from the triplet P0 state to the singlet S0 state is doubly forbidden. It violates spin statistics as it goes from a triplet to a singlet, and it's also a J equals 0 to J equals 0 transition, which is a forbidden transition by dipole selection rule. As a result, the state is extremely long-lived, and for our purposes, can be considered as stable. With my collaborators, we pointed out two important features of that make these alkaline earth atoms extremely and extremely powerful simulators of many-body physics. In particular, this is again the example of strontium 87, and now we recall that it has nuclear spin 9½. So that's why each of these electronic levels has a bunch of nuclear Zeeman levels as well. So the first feature is that these two states, because the excited state is stable, can be used as two orbitals. And then together with the nuclear spin, they can be used to implement, to study spin orbital physics, as shown in this cartoon, where the two colors correspond to the two orbitals, yellow and green, and the red arrow describes the nuclear spin. Spin orbital physics plays a very important role in condensed matter physics, and in particular, we showed that this system can then be used to simulate the so-called Kondo lattice model, which is believed to underlie colossal magnetoresistance, which I mentioned in the beginning of the talk. Furthermore, this long lifetime of 150 seconds, just if you take the inverse of it, corresponds to a very narrow line width. And such narrow line widths make these atoms into very good atomic clocks, and they're indeed used as such in many experiments. And thanks to our detailed analysis of the behavior of these alkaline earth atoms in optical lattices, we were actually able to understand and help experimentalists suppress unwanted collisional effects in such alkaline earth clocks, helping experimentalists improve the precision of these clocks. The second feature is SUN symmetry. So because nuclear spin is 9½ here, there are n equal 10 nuclear Zeeman levels. Now, both of these states are J equals 0 states. So J is the total electronic angular momentum. And therefore, because J is equal to 0, J dot I, for example, is 0. And so there is no hyperfine structure, and the nuclear spin is really decoupled from the electron. However, when two atoms collide, it's really the electronic clouds that collide. And since the nuclear spin is decoupled, we really expect the scattering length to be independent of the nuclear spin. Now, for the non-experts, scattering lengths, of course, are the only parameters that are needed to describe collisions at low energy. Furthermore, the lattice beams that create the potential also actually act on the electrons. And since the nucleus is decoupled, we also expect the lattice potential to be independent of the nuclear spin. So as a result, we expect the whole many-body dynamics to be really invariant under the permutations of these nuclear Zeeman levels. And this permutation, or rotation rather, symmetry is called precisely SUN symmetry. So why is this SUN symmetry so exciting? In some sense, the atoms are trying to choose from many different nuclear Zeeman levels to point at nuclear spin directions to point into. But because of SUN symmetry, all of these directions are somewhat equivalent. And the atoms are confused and don't know where to point. In a sense, they are frustrated. And this frustration is somewhat similar to geometrical frustration, for example, in triangular antiferromagnets, where we cannot satisfy all bonds if we want to anti-align the spins. We cannot satisfy all bonds at the same time, which leads to a lot of classically degenerate ground states. So here, similarly, SUN symmetry leads to a lot of degenerate ground states, which leads to a frustration of the spin system. As a result of this frustration, the system ends up settling into exotic ground states. And while making atoms frustrated, exotic ground states, of course, make a physicist happy. So the particular exotic ground states that I'm talking about here are valence bond solid phases, which I will describe in a little bit of detail later, and the closely related quantum spin liquid phases. So quantum spin liquids are phases in which spins are highly correlated, but at the same time strongly fluctuate. And one reason there is so much excitement about these quantum spin liquids is because sometimes their excitations can be non-abelian anions, which can of course then be used for topological quantum computing. And while there are hundreds of papers on quantum spin liquids in condensed matter literature, they have not yet been realized experimentally. And so it would be very exciting if the system of alkaline earth atoms is actually the first one to observe such quantum spin liquids. Another reason why SUN symmetric systems are exciting is because a single system can be used to map the phase diagram as a function of n. So to understand this, let's start with an example that's possibly familiar to me, but maybe not as familiar to people here, is an example of alkali atoms which only have SU2 symmetry. And let's consider an F equals 2 hyperfine state of such atoms, where F is just the total atomic angular momentum, and M here is the Z component of this total angular momentum. And then an M equals 0 and an M equals 1 atom can generally scatter into M equals minus 1 and M equals 2. The reason this is possible is because different total F for two atoms can have different scattering lengths. However, if we had here the full SU5 symmetry, then all scattering lengths would be the same, and actually the scattering would not be able to take place. So as a result, in an SU5 system, if some of these Zeeman levels are originally unoccupied, they will stay unoccupied throughout the time evolution. And in particular, in this case, an n equals 10 atom, such as, say, strontium 87, can be used to reproduce the behavior of all lower n just by choosing the initial state, which allows to get access in an experiment to such an intrinsically theoretical object as the phase diagram as a function of n. So let me give you now one example where this SUN symmetry can give rise to exotic ground states. And here the particular example will be the valence bond solid phase. Let's first start with a familiar example where n is equal to 2. That is, we have two nuclear spin components, like the two components of electronic spin, for example. And let's put one ground state atom per site on a square lattice. This model is described by the tunneling amplitude T of two atoms between neighboring sites, and by the interaction energy U between two atoms when they're on the same site. Let's suppose that tunneling is much smaller than the interactions. And then it is energetically costly for two atoms to sit on the same site. In that case, each atom ends up localizing on its own site and can be described by a spin 1/2 operator Si on site I. However, the atoms can still virtually hop to neighboring sites and back, giving rise to effective spin-spin interactions between neighboring spins, which can be described by a spin Hamiltonian. In this case, the spin Hamiltonian is an SU2 symmetric Heisenberg antiferromagnet. So this, of course, stands for nearest neighbors. Antiferromagnetism, of course, means that to minimize this Hamiltonian, you have to anti-align the spins. And SU2 symmetry here means that you can rotate all the spins simultaneously, and then this Hamiltonian will be invariant. If you had just two of these spins, then the ground state would be an SU2 singlet, where the singlet here means a one-dimensional representation of SU2. So what is the lowest energy state of the full square lattice? So one might naively think, just from this information here, that maybe the ground state is just an array of independent singlets. Alternatively, one could use classical intuition and suppose that maybe the ground state has this long-range antiferromagnetic order, up, down, up, down. In the case of n equals 2, this turns out to be the right answer. However, this is not necessarily true for larger n. And let's consider now n equals 5. That is, we have 5 nuclear spin components. And let's put our atoms in a square lattice in the following checkerboard pattern, where we have one ground state atom on a site with a small green circle and 4 ground state atoms on a site with a large green circle. This configuration can be the lowest energy configuration in the absence of tunneling, provided we adjust the depths of the relative depths of the wells appropriately. And then let's again suppose that tunneling is much smaller than the interactions. In that case, we can again describe each site by localized spin, but virtual hopping now again gives rise to a spin Hamiltonian, which now has SU5 symmetry. We can tune this bias delta to make sure the interactions are, again, still anti-ferromagnetic. Now, the key is that to make an SU2 singlet, we need two fermions. But to make an SUN singlet that is a one-dimensional representation of SUN, we actually need n of these fermions, n of these atoms. Furthermore, the energy of an SUN singlet scales as minus nt squared over u. So the larger n is, the more favorable it is to form these SUN singlets. And in this picture, two neighboring sites can form an SU5 singlet. And while in the previous slide, it was more favorable to form long-range antiferromagnetic order than SU2 singlets, in this case, it is actually more favorable because of this factor n here to form SU5 singlets. And indeed, the ground state of this model has been shown to be very close to an array of independent singlets and is called a valence bond solid phase and is gapped and has broken rotational symmetry, as you can see. So one reason this valence bond solid phases are so exciting is because they can be thought of as stepping stones towards the more exotic quantum spin liquid phases, which can sometimes be thought of as superpositions of these valence bond solids made up of different arrangements of such valence bonds. And indeed, a similar arrangement of atoms has been shown to possibly give rise to precisely the exotic quantum spin liquid phases. The field of many-body physics with alkaline earth atoms is young, rich, and growing very fast, with many outstanding challenges whose solution will hopefully form an important part of my future work. So let me mention just some of these challenges. If two excited state triplet P0 atoms collide, one of them can fall down to the ground state, while the other one can get excited to some other state, which brings with it the challenge of describing the resulting dissipative many-body dynamics, which takes place in the presence of this SUN symmetry and the two orbital feature that we discussed, which was already lots of fun to study, even without time dependence and without the dissipation. Now, in addition to being interesting from the fundamental point of view, this problem is also directly applicable to atomic clock experiments. Now, for me, probably the most exciting part in this research is the impressive experimental progress. And indeed, quantum degenerate alkaline earth fermions have already been loaded into a three-dimensional optical lattice in Japan and in Austria. And it's particularly pleasing to see an expression like SU2 cross SU6 appear in a title of an experimental cold atom paper. So one challenge, however, that remains in the field and that I try to tackle in my research is to develop methods for preparing and detecting the exotic phases, such as topological phases or quantum spin liquid phases, that have no local order parameter and are instead characterized by a pattern of long-range entanglement. So one idea, for example, is to use edge states to detect topological phases, which is, of course, a well-known tool in condensed matter systems. In particular, the Japanese group has recently demonstrated that fermionic and bosonic alkaline earth atoms can sometimes phase separate, as shown in this picture. And then, if we're in an appropriate two-dimensional geometry and the fermions are in the appropriate topological phase, then the boundary between the bosons and the fermions will necessarily support a topologically protected edge mode. And then by sending and detecting wave packets along this edge mode, we can study the properties of the underlying bulk topological phase. And in general, I would say that there is a largely unexplored field of studying interface physics with ultra-cold atoms, where, of course, interface physics is a very well-developed subject in condensed matter systems. A major challenge, however, that remains is that interactions between neutral atoms, both alkali and alkaline earth atoms, are typically very weak and short-range, making it very difficult to observe the desired physics. And here, polar molecules provide the solution. We'll be interested in molecules made up of two different nuclei, in which case the electronic cloud is distributed unevenly between the two atoms, endowing the molecule with a permanent electric dipole moment. The other property of these molecules that we'll be interested in is the rotation of the two nuclei around each other. And then let's imagine putting these molecules, again, as we did with the atoms, in an optical lattice. We can use then the rotation to encode for an effective spin 1/2 degree of freedom to model our electrons. And then these electric dipole-dipole interactions can be used to mediate interactions between the effective spins that we have just defined. And let's call these interactions J. The molecules can also tunnel from site to site with amplitude T. As I will show in the next few slides, the resulting model is actually a highly tunable generalization of the famous TJ model, which is believed to play an important role in high-temperature superconductivity. In order to introduce the TJ model, let's first forget about the molecules, and let's just consider the generic fermionic Hubbard model, which we have already seen in the earlier slides. So in this model, C dagger J sigma creates a fermion on side J with spin sigma, and J sigma counts the number of fermions on side J with spin sigma. The first term here describes the tunneling of the fermions between neighboring sites, and this term describes on-site interactions between two fermions that are on the same site. And as I mentioned, this model is supposed to play an important role in high-temperature superconductivity and has been realized in cold atoms. Now let's imagine tunneling is much weaker than the interaction energy U. In that case, double occupancy becomes energetically costly, and therefore the ground Hilbert space will have at most one fermion per site, realizing an effective hardcore constraint. However, then, exactly in the case as in the case of alkaline earth atoms, virtual hopping will give rise to effective spin-spin interactions of order T squared over U. However, in contrast to alkaline earth atoms, we don't assume here an average integer filling of atoms per site, so that the tunneling T will also be allowed to first order. So the resulting model is precisely called the TJ model. So let's look at this TJ model in a little bit more detail. So here, because of strong interactions, double occupancy is forbidden, but this virtual hopping gives rise to spin-spin interaction J, which have the following form. So here, Nj is just the total number of atoms on site J, and this can be either 0 or 1. Szj is the z component of the spin operator on site J, and S plus J flips the spin of the fermion on site J from down to up. So the first term here is just an anti-ferromagnetic Ising type interaction, which prefers to anti-align the spins. This term results in the flip-flops of the spins between neighboring sites, while this term is density-density attraction between neighboring sites. And this actually makes sense because if the fermions are not on neighboring sites, they cannot take advantage of this virtual hopping. Yes?
What's breaking the symmetry that gives you a z term here?
So in this case, it's actually not broken. I just broke it down to understand these terms, because later when we do it with the molecules, it will actually be broken. So excellent question, right? Of course, with cold atoms, you could easily break the symmetry by, for example, having the up and the down fermions hop with different amplitudes T, and then you could break the SU2 symmetry. But this is SU2 symmetric.
Sorry, how do you get them to break?
So this J here, as you may possibly remember from the previous slide, comes from these T squared over U processes.
Yeah.
So if your T up and T down are different, so if the up fermions,
right.
Say, suppose the up fermions can hop and the down fermions cannot hop.
But how do you achieve that?
How do you achieve this? If these are not spins, if there are some complicated internal states of the atoms, you can make sure that one type of internal state sees a deep lattice, and the other one sees a very shallow lattice. But here, we're just actually talking about the usual TJ model for the electrons, where it is indeed SU2 symmetric. Good question. So it is actually this part of the Hubbard model that is believed to play an important role in high-temperature superconductivity and to exhibit the associated exotic D-wave pairing of the fermions. So for the non-experts, D-wave pairing just means that the Cooper pairs change the sign on rotation by 90 degrees, as shown in this picture. So in the case of cold atoms, the interaction U comes from collisions, and it's actually limited by about 1 kilohertz. Since T has to be much smaller than U, T squared over U will necessarily be much smaller than U. As a result, these J interactions in cold atoms are much smaller than a kilohertz, and they're very difficult to observe experimentally. So what we're proposing is instead to use cold polar molecules in which J can be implemented directly through dipole-dipole interactions, which can be much stronger. And then you can use on-site interactions or possibly even chemical reactions to implement this hardcore constraint. Okay, so now this is probably somewhat technical. So let's explain now how this TJ model arises from dipole-dipole interactions between polar molecules. We're going to describe the rotation of the molecule by the angular momentum operator n. And then the molecule will obey the following simple rigid rotor Hamiltonian, where b is the rotational constant. The eigenstates of this Hamiltonian are, of course, characterized by the total angular momentum and its projection on the z-axis. And the energy is, of course, given by the following familiar formula. So the lowest four states here are the n equals 0 state and the three degenerate n equals 1 states with the three projections of angular momentum on the z-axis. So let's remove some of the formulas to free up some space. And let's suppose that we have a DC electric field that's applied along the z-axis. This will add a DC Stark shift term to our Hamiltonian, where dz is the projection of the dipole moment of the molecule on the z-axis. As a result of the applied DC electric field, the degeneracy between the three n equals 1 states will be partially broken, because states with the same nz will be mixed by this DC Stark shift term. So let's refer to these two states as our effective spin up and spin down that will correspond to the spin up and spin down of the electrons that we're trying to simulate. Because of the applied DC electric field, this state will now have a permanent dipole moment, d up. This state will have a permanent dipole moment, d down. And there will also be a transition dipole moment, d up down, between these two states. However, since the DC electric field is along the z-axis, all three of these dipole moments are actually also along the z-axis, and this will be very important shortly. So let's imagine now putting these molecules in an optical lattice, and let's refer to the vector connecting molecules I and J as Rij. Then dipole-dipole interactions between these molecules can be written in the following familiar form, where Di and Dj are just the dipole operators for the molecules I and J, and this is the magnitude and the unit vector of this vector. So now, first of all, let's suppose that dipole-dipole interactions are much weaker than this energy splitting between this level and that level. And then dipole-dipole interactions will be too weak to populate these energy levels, provided that we start only with levels up, levels down and up. And therefore, since all three of these dipole moments are aligned along the z-axis, only the z component of the dipole operators will matter. And then this whole expression just simplifies to the product of the z components of the two of the dipole moments of the two molecules. And let's for a moment ignore the transition dipole moment d up down. In that case, the z component of the dipole moment of molecule I is just equal to d up if the molecule is in the state up, and it's equal to d down if the molecule is in the state down. Similarly for the jth molecule. The transition dipole moment will allow the molecules to flip-flop between neighboring sites with a coefficient proportional to the square of the transition dipole moment. Now let's rewrite n up and n down in terms of the total n and sz. This is just a simple rewriting of this line, where now we have defined these four new coefficients, jz, v, w, and jperp, which can be expressed in this simple fashion. So here jperp is just proportional to the square of the transition dipole moment, while jz, v, and w are simple functions of the two permanent dipole moments. Because in the original TJ model, we had only one interaction j, and because here we have more terms, we will refer to this model as the TJVW model, standing for these V and W here. So now, how is this model different from the usual TJ model? So this is the usual TJ model. While with polar molecules, this SU2 symmetric interaction is actually replaced with this much more complicated interaction that's characterized by coefficients jz, jperp, v, and w. So what are the differences? So first of all, the nearest neighbor interaction is now replaced with long-range 1 over r cubed interactions. The SU2 symmetric interactions are now replaced with a more general XXZ type spin-spin interactions, where we can in principle tune these coefficients jz and jperp relative to each other. The coefficient in front of density-density interaction is now also in principle tunable. And we also get a density-spin interaction. One way to think about this interaction is that the presence of the molecule on site I creates a magnetic field for a molecule on site j, effective magnetic field. So what are the features of this model? Well, first of all, this is the motivation that we started with. Because the interactions are implemented directly through dipole-dipole interactions, these interactions jz, jperp, v, and w are much stronger than interactions j in cold atoms. One technical achievement of our papers was that we showed that all four of these coefficients, jz, jperp, v, and w, can all be controlled in sign and magnitude independently from each other and from the tunneling T by applying microwave fields. So these two properties then, the strong interactions and the high tunability, make these polar molecules into incredibly powerful simulators of a many-body phenomenon. And in particular, we hope that they might be able to help us get insights into various condensed matter phenomena, such as frustrated magnetism, or possibly even high-temperature superconductivity. And in particular, using a certain perturbative approximation, we show that this model can be used to stabilize, for example, D-wave superfluidity. So maybe a short explanation of convention is in order. So these molecules are actually neutral, so they cannot really conduct. And therefore, superconductivity of charged fermionic electrons is in this case equivalent to the superfluidity of these neutral fermionic molecules. As in the case of alkaline earth atoms, the field of many-body physics with polar molecules is young, rich, and growing very fast, with many outstanding challenges. The solution will form an important part of my future work. So let's mention some of these challenges. Both atoms in the molecule can have a nuclear spin. And it is still an outstanding challenge to take full advantage of this nuclear spin as an extra quantum degree of freedom in the context of this generalized TJ model. And in addition to being interesting from the fundamental point of view, this nuclear spin can be used as an important resource in quantum information applications. Another challenge is to try to understand the effects of long-range dipolar interactions on the TJ model, because the usual TJ model only has the short-range interactions. And it is particularly important to try to understand the effects of these long-range interactions on the exotic D-wave superfluidity. Finally, one could remove the optical lattice, in which case molecules can form a so-called Wigner crystal. And this will add to our spin physics the physics of vibrations or phonons. Furthermore, in Wigner crystals, molecules can be much closer to each other than in an optical lattice, which will make the spin-spin interactions actually much stronger, and therefore possibly easier to observe. And now, as in the case of alkaline earth atoms, the most exciting part of this field probably is the impressive experimental progress. And my collaborators at Boulder have already loaded the KRB polar molecule into three-dimensional optical lattice, and are hopefully going to see some of this exciting physics very soon in their lab. So these are the references for the alkaline earth and polar molecule parts of the talk. So in the alkaline earth discussion, I mostly focused on many-body physics, but it turns out that the same two features of SUN symmetry and two orbitals make these alkaline earth atoms into ideal building blocks for atomic clocks and for quantum computing applications. So while I have already discussed the outlook for the exciting future of alkaline earth and polar molecule projects, which will definitely be an important part of my future research, let me maybe spend the last 10 or 15 minutes, describing the more general outlook for the future of my research, both short-term and long-term. As I said in the beginning of the talk, the large long-term goal of my research is to understand and control larger interacting quantum systems, as well as to design and create new ones. And to achieve these quests, I try to integrate tools and methods from atomic, molecular, and optical physics, condensed matter physics, and quantum information science. Some specific goals along this research program are, one is, of course, to use these AMO systems to implement some cool new quantum technologies, such as quantum computers, quantum communication devices, atomic clocks, electric field sensors, or magnetic field sensors. Another goal, which is what I spend most of the talk on, is to use AMO systems to simulate condensed matter phenomena or get access to general exotic many-body phenomena. And here, the main goal would be to try to scale small controllable AMO systems to large and interacting ones. In contrast to condensed matter systems, AMO systems are often far out of equilibrium, are evolving in time, and are subject to dissipation. To show this a little bit more graphically and much more vaguely, is if we think of a typical many-body Hilbert space as represented by the inside of this blue circle, then condensed matter systems might be able to access a small part of it, while AMO systems might be able to access a much bigger part. And condensed matter systems, a typical condensed matter system, is studied near thermal equilibrium, as represented, say, by this small purple dot. While AMO systems, because of how controllable they are, they can be easily taken far out of equilibrium and can be studied in the presence of time evolution, as represented schematically by this dashed green line. And then I would say that as a result, there's actually a whole new world of quantum physics to understand, classify, and possibly use for applications. And so in my research, I tried to tackle the challenge of developing tools and methods for studying these new types of many-body phenomena. And one goal would be here to try to extend the large variety of very amazing tools available in condensed matter to these new types of many-body phenomena. Now, entanglement is a new tool that quantum information has recently given to the condensed matter community for studying or even defining quantum phases, which is, of course, a very important topic here at Perimeter. And I would say that atomic physicists are actually extremely good at measuring and characterizing entanglement in AMO systems. So I'm pretty sure that in the near future, many-body AMO systems will play an extremely important role in understanding entanglement in many-body quantum systems. And so I tried to guide my research in the direction of studying entanglement in many-body AMO systems. Hopefully, throughout the talk, I convinced you that ultra-cold atoms, such as alkaline earth atoms, and polar molecules will play a very important role in the near future in understanding and controlling larger interacting quantum systems. In particular, they will probably play a very important role in understanding condensed matter phenomena and also implementing general exotic many-body phenomena. However, I would say that probably they're not ideal for implementing certain quantum technologies such as quantum computers or quantum communication devices. Indeed, it is difficult to imagine an entire Bose-Einstein condensate apparatus, for example, to be at the heart of a quantum computer. Furthermore, it is somewhat difficult to interface cold atoms and molecules with a silicon-based classical computer technology. And for this reason, I would say that maybe defects in solids, especially if they can be controlled at room temperature, are a much better solution for implementing quantum computers. Similarly, it's difficult to carry quantum information over long distances in atoms and molecules. And here, of course, photons provide a much better solution. So a research program that aims not only at understanding and controlling large interacting quantum systems, which is just a fundamental reason, but also aims at implementing practical technologies would benefit from studying defects in solids and photons. And in my research, I also try to address these topics, as I will show in the next few slides. And of course, these two systems will also bring with them exciting new many-body physics. And let me start with the defects in solids. Yes, please.
Something about
people are getting good at, or AI model people are good at measuring entanglement. Did you mean theoretically measuring? Or
no, actually experimentally.
How do you experimentally?
Right. So the beginning of the talk, so I showed this cartoon. It's a movie, a real-time movie, actually, of people being able to measure, for example, the presence at the moment of single atoms in these optical lattices, which you know I introduced in the beginning. So people will very soon be able to get access to this very large atomic system and be able to measure, you know, the state of every single atom in that system with very high precision. So of course, so this will allow you to get, for example, access to, say, you know, few particle entanglement. Of course, it's an important question: how would you measure something more complicated, like, for example, the entanglement entropy, which involves, you know, a whole system? And these are important questions. But the general thing that I meant is that so far, AMO experimentalists are very good at measuring entanglement between, you know, few atoms or few molecules, and they're hoping to extend this capability to larger systems.
They measure joint states of pairs of molecules or something?
Yeah. So you would do the following. So you try to prepare, say, with two atoms. They would try to prepare a particular two-atom state, and then they can very well do, say, the full tomography of that state, for example, or three. But of course, for a larger number of particles, full tomography becomes really difficult. And here, one somehow needs to combine the knowledge of quantum information scientists and the power of AMO experimentalists to come up with the best possible measurement. Thank you for the question. Okay, so I believe that in the near future, nitrogen vacancy defects in diamond will play a very important role from both fundamental and practical points of view. As you possibly remember from Liang's talk from December, these nitrogen defects in diamond are formed by removing two carbon atoms from the diamond lattice and replacing one of them with a nitrogen and leaving the other site empty. The system can be thought of as an atom trapped in a diamond lattice, and it has a spin 1 electronic ground state, which has very good coherence properties at room temperatures and can be addressed optically. So these and other features of NV defects in diamond made it extremely favorable for various applications such as many body physics, quantum computation, and precision measurements. In the short term, it is very likely that these NV defects will give rise to practical measurement devices such as magnetometers, atomic clocks, or electric field sensors. And all of these applications are in need of theoretical support, in particular to study and improve coherence properties in the system, as well as to be able to use entanglement to improve the precision of the measurement devices. As better and better control in these systems is available, it is becoming increasingly important to design exotic but at the same time experimentally realistic spin models, for example, in arrays of such nitrogen vacancy centers, coupled, for example, through magnetic dipole-dipole interactions. And I'm collaborating with some of my friends at Harvard on a model that tries to simulate gauge fields in such spin models. And of course, the long-term challenge is to try to build a room temperature quantum computer with this system, which we believe is actually possible. But there are lots of theoretical and experimental challenges that remain to be solved and that I will try to address in my future work. While defects in solids are ideal, in my opinion, for implementing quantum computer technologies, photons are excellent for long-distance quantum communication. So photons generally don't interact. And therefore, a grand long-term challenge of the quantum optics part of my research is to try to implement and study strongly interacting photons. So in addition quantum communication and optical quantum computation more efficient, strongly interacting photons may allow to improve the precision of imaging and metrology. Furthermore, strongly interacting photons give rise to a wealth of exotic many-body physics. And in fact, I would guess that possibly the study of many-body physics with strongly interacting photons is actually the future of quantum optics. A typical approach to creating strongly interacting photons is to take two photons and make them strongly interact with a single enharmonic system, such as an atom. However, we have just spent the whole talk discussing strong dipole-dipole interactions between polar molecules and strong collisional interactions between atoms. So one then wonders whether one can somehow map these strong interactions in atomic systems to strong interactions between photons. And the idea would be to suppose that we have many atoms that strongly interact with each other, and then, thanks to strong atom-photon interactions, we can use these strong dipolar or collisional interactions between atoms to create effective photon-photon interactions. Two systems that I think will be particularly promising and exciting in the coming years in implementing this scheme are photons propagating in Rydberg media and photons propagating in optical nanofibers. So Rydberg atoms are atoms in highly excited electronic states, and as a result, they often have large electric dipole moments, which can then interact with each other through electric dipole-dipole interactions, much like the polar molecules that we discussed. And then via this scheme, these strong electric dipole-dipole interactions, together with atom-photon interactions, can give rise to interactions between photons. And let me refer you to this paper for some hints regarding the wealth of dissipative many-body dynamics of photons that can be studied in the system. And instead, let me give one slide on optical nanofibers. In order to implement this scheme, one has to first implement strong atom-photon interactions. One approach to implementing strong atom-photon interactions is to guide light along an optical nanofiber, as in this experiment in Germany. And then atoms trapped along this optical nanofiber can strongly interact with the guided light mode, whose transverse profile here is shown in brown. And indeed, Jeff Kimball's group at Caltech has recently demonstrated that only 1,000 atoms in such a system can give an optical depth of 100, which means that only 10 atoms in the system are enough to make the medium optically thick, which is indeed the sign of strong atom-photon interactions. And then, using collisions between the atoms, one can use these strong atom-photon interactions to implement robust photon-photon quantum gates. But more interestingly, from my point of view, is that the guided mode here can be used to implement long-range interactions between the atoms, which can in turn allow one to get access to exotic spin models defined on these atoms. However, because of spontaneous emission in free space and into the guided mode, these spin models would necessarily be dissipative. And therefore, this brings the challenge of understanding and controlling dissipative many-body dynamics and entanglement in such systems, which is something that I'm working on with my theoretical and experimental collaborators at Caltech and in Barcelona. And we're hoping to see some of this physics very soon in the experiments of Jeff Kimball. So throughout the talk, I mostly focused on the use of AMO systems to simulate condensed matter phenomena or to study general exotic many-body phenomena. But I share with many of my collaborators that possibly the future of quantum simulation with AMO systems actually lies in the simulation of phenomena from high-energy physics. And one really ambitious goal here would be, for example, to surpass the power of numerical lattice QCD methods. Now, I'm not at all an expert in the field of high-energy physics, and I'm just learning very little bits and collaborating with my friends at Caltech on one project related to simulating high-energy phenomena with AMO systems. So let me end by saying that my research has always been motivated by and done in collaboration with experimental groups, and therefore experiments are usually the most exciting part of the research. And I'm confident that in the future, experiments will bring with them new unexpected challenges, which we will necessarily have to factor into this research program. So with this, let me thank my collaborators and thank you for your attention.
So
for the simulations,
yeah,
the optical lattices, what happens when you have errors? I mean, you get obviously some different system that's not quite the Hamiltonian you wanted, but what does it look like from the scatter point of view?
Right. So, so this is a very popular question. So I guess the question you're asking, if you're trying to do a quantum simulation on a quantum computer, right, then you can try to do some error correction on the simulation. But if you're trying to do this quantum simulation in an analog fashion, I mean, how should you, why should you trust anything, right? That's roughly probably what you're asking. So here are some possible answers to that question. So one answer is that, so this is the answer by D.D. Lightfried. So if you try to, you always try to answer, to ask some qualitative questions. So because of the errors, I mean, you cannot possibly aim for, you know, a really sort of quantitative answer, sort of looking for a number. So that would be very hard in these, you know, uncontrolled, in a sense, quantum simulators. So then you would ask some qualitative questions. And if you simulate the same Hamiltonian in many different systems, and the answer to your qualitative question is the same, then you would hope that maybe you didn't make the same kind of mistake in all of these quantum simulators. So this is a very naive answer. So, and it's open to definitely debate. Now, a slightly deeper answer is that the questions you're asking or the phenomena that you're looking for are somewhat, they're somewhat stable to perturbations, because you're probably looking at some condensed matter phenomenon that, you know, and the system has its own disorder, its own dirt, its own perturbations. And then one has to try to formalize how the probability, you know, how does the fact that the system that you have is stable to perturbations, can this be used to predict that maybe many simulators of that system that have different kinds of perturbations would also be stable in exhibiting that phenomenon? And this is, you know, this is right now sort of very vague, and that's what people are hoping to prove. Although some other people are hoping to disprove that and say that all of these analog quantum simulators are just useless.
Yeah, I mean, so you made this point that the atomic systems, the AMO systems, have, you know, dynamics and,
right,
and other kinds of behavior that you don't usually think about in the condensed matter system.
Right.
So that kind of suggests that errors will do things that aren't like the that doesn't mean that the properties you're looking at won't be robust, but
right.
I mean, but you know, in a specific system, you kind of can tell what the likely errors are going to be. And
So the general procedure, right, that people use is they start sort of with a small system, maybe a one-dimensional system, say,
mm-hmm,
that you can actually model and, you know, solve using various, you know, techniques like DMRG or something. And then you try and carefully compare first, you know, for two atoms, how they interact with each other, then for a full 1D system, you know, whether your experiment matches your simulation, because then you can actually, your numerics, because then you can actually do. And then, but then, you know, once you get to the full large system, and hopefully you're trying to simulate something that you don't know how to solve, then somehow all bets are off, and then you're just hoping that it works. And you hope that this will not add any other noises that
I'm asking about a different approach. Because, I mean, you say, well, you know, we have the atoms hopping around,
yeah,
so therefore they can simulate this Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
But can you apply that same kind of technique to say, well, what happens if there's some errors, we're not doing exactly what we want, we get, you know, this other Hamiltonian or this open system instead?
Sure. Well, you could definitely say that. I mean, the question is that suppose you want to simulate, you know, this particular Hamiltonian from some condensed matter context. So, and then you would have to do sort of this program that I said. But of course, yes, you can try estimating these errors, and you can write down a different Hamiltonian or maybe a master equation that includes all of these errors,
yeah,
but then often you will just not be able to solve it in the same way that you can't solve the original one that you tried to simulate.
But I guess the question was just, can you interpret, if you've done this, can you interpret that master equation in terms of the condensed matter model or not? I mean,
probably not. I mean, the condensed matter people say, you know, what do you mean you prepare your electrons in the highest excited electronic state, you know? I mean, or what do you mean for example, this SU2 symmetry? I mean, if you don't apply any magnetic fields in condensed matter systems, you will rarely get these x, x, z type interactions. And so it would be hard. No, these are very, very good questions. These are the key, actually, to all of the sort of quantum simulation questions. That's why it's actually easier to motivate, probably, this research just by saying that we will study just general exotic phenomena that are not observed in condensed matter. And then it's a little bit easier, actually, and more exciting.
Actually, first, I have just a linguistic question. Why is there an O in AMO? It has to do with atoms and molecules.
Atomic, molecular, optical.
O is for optical?
Optical. That's why the photons were there. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. This was in the first slides.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's an excellent question. Sorry, I introduced it and then didn't repeat it.
But then a couple of times you highlighted the need to study out of equilibrium phenomena.
Yeah.
So what new theoretical techniques do you plan to bring to bear to do that?
Right. So
path integrals?
Yes. So right, exactly. So the idea is roughly as follows. So So AMO physicists have always been studying these far-out equilibrium phenomena, but just, you know, for two atoms. You know, you try to study two atoms, and then they interact somehow, and you try to maybe apply some quantum gates, and people know how to describe this, maybe through the master equation. You know, you write a density matrix, and you see how this density matrix evolves under the master equation. But now, for example, doing the same thing to a larger many-body quantum system, see how it evolves in time, say, under the master equation. I mean, it's not so obvious, and I believe there are some, you know, condensed matter people who are thinking now about how to extend, for example, you know, the path integral formulation to the, you know, to the density matrix evolving under the master equation. And I'm sort of discussing various avenues like this, for example, with the condensed matter theorists at Caltech, Gil Raphael. So these are some of the ideas. But you know, I'm also actually not an expert in condensed matter theory, so I try to collaborate with people, and we try to sort of exchange expertise.
Did you complete any numerical experiments using your approach, or you're just in
the beginning? No. So the reason I didn't talk about this is because it gets somewhat detailed, so I skipped this. So for these polar molecules, so once you're in two dimensions, the numerics become extremely complicated and, you know, also somewhat unreliable. But in one dimension, you can use this density matrix renormalization group to study one-dimensional systems. I personally don't do these calculations myself, but I collaborate with people who do. And for example, I collaborated with a guy, Salvatore Manmana. So he's a postdoc at Boulder with Anna Maria Ray. And so what we did is we took the known results for this TJ model, you know, the usual TJ model with the electrons' nearest neighbor interactions. And first, we tuned some of these parameters, like these JZ and J-perp relative to each other, to the most simple experimentally realizable case with molecules. And then we introduced, instead of these short-range interactions, introduced the long-range interactions. And in one dimension, compared, for example, how the superfluid part of the phase, you know, changes as you make these various changes from the usual TJ model to this molecular TJ model. And we actually found that in that particular case, say the size of the superfluid phase in the phase diagram increases, and that made us happy. And you know, we could write a paper saying that you can enhance the superfluid phase with these polar molecules.
So you do have a complication on this one.
Yes. So it was one of them. Sure. Yes.
So imagine simulating dynamical gauge fields.
Simulating what?
Dynamical gauge fields.
Yes. This is very simple. So if you take, in general, a spin 1/2 spin Hamiltonian, then you can rewrite it in terms of hardcore bosons. But if your original spin-spin interactions have very peculiar form, then the resulting hardcore bosons, as they hop around, say, a square, they can actually pick up a phase, you know. And this way, you can actually implement. It won't be a dynamical gauge field. It will just be a static gauge field in which the bosons move. And it turns out pretty difficult to design such spin Hamiltonians where, you know, these flip-flop terms, which give rise to the tunneling, where they have a phase that, that you can pick up and that is actually non-zero. And here we think actually dipole-dipole interaction in these microwave fields provide enough control.
Oh, that's background gauge.
Yeah, it's background. It's not dynamical. It's static gauge field in which these bosons, which come from spin 1/2 particles, move. So it's a, it's very, it's not as ambitious. But there are people also trying to implement, of course, dynamic gauge fields with cold atoms. I'm not yet involved in that.
Maybe you also said this in the beginning. How many atoms can you get or molecules in an optical lattice?
Yeah, so I actually didn't say that. Well, in the picture, so I showed this movie. Well, typically you would have, say, in a three-dimensional optical lattice, the numbers are typically maybe 30 by 30 by 30 or 100 by 100 by 100. These are pretty big systems. So 10 to the whatever, 6th at most. But then the larger they are, sort of the harder they are to control. The movie that I showed was just a two-dimensional case, but now they're sort of three-dimensional. Since it's three-dimensional, it's actually hard to, you know, take movies of these things, you know, when you're three-dimensional.
I have one other question. You talked about getting strong interactions among photons.
Yeah.
There are these very these slow light systems.
Yeah.
Those are strong.
So
I mean,
that's precisely.
Is that the kind of thing that you were
exactly,
talking
about? Exactly. So that's what actually what that. So these Rydberg atoms, what I mentioned, so you need a strong interaction between the atoms because that's what this sort of scheme relies on. But you also need strong interactions between atoms and photons. And actually one way to get access to these strong interactions between atoms and photons is to have another extra sort of control field that will try to give you sort of strong atom-photon interactions without scattering. And one way of doing this is precisely this slow light technique. That's what I spent actually my first 2 years of the PhD on was the slow light. So that's where I'm really coming from.
Yes, early on you were talking about finding some experimental realization of a quantum spin liquid, and the motivation one of the motivations you said was that the excitations can be non-abelian anions. And then I understand that's kind of like a dream, but I wish I had a better picture of where that dream is going. I normally think of. So the idea kind of roughly is that you have these excitations and then you're supposed to permute or grade them in some way and operate. Normally I would think of a liquid as being, it would sound hard to sort of put some excitations in a liquid and then manipulate it and grade them.
So the question is, how would you braid them? How would you create them?
Yes, yeah, maybe all those. Well, I guess I can intuit how you would create them. But yeah, is there some schematic picture of how you would?
What confuses you is what these excitations look like. So I'm actually also, you know, not an expert in this, and probably people here who are better experts. So these excitations, I guess they're localized because they're in some sense, you know, singularities. They're kind of like these vortices and this anion sense of the heart. And so you can imagine, I mean, these are some of the proposals that I've seen, at least when you have real spins that have, you know, real magnetic moments, then you can try to sort of, you know, guide these, you know, anions somehow with various potentials, for example. I think in this sense, I mean, this is really the motivation, but I mean, I'm finding it extremely hard to believe that what will actually create these quantum spin liquids with AMO systems and, you know, drag these, you know, anionic excitations. I just don't think that's very practical. I would say it's more exciting than practical. And so, in particular, creating these anions in this AMO system, I don't think it's a very good way to study these spin liquids. And that's why I actually mentioned the, these edge states. I think that's more interesting. So I wouldn't even, so I actually haven't thought of how to create them practically in experiments as far as how they create practically in models. You apply a particular operator on your spin model, you know, and this creates two of these anions, and then you apply some more operators and these anions, you know, move from, you know, one side to the other. How you do this experimentally, I actually haven't thought. I mean, maybe that's a good thing to do after we've done these simpler things.
Questions?
Okay, let's see.